Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redston. Today, I'm talking to Heath Monaghan from the Aspire Community Centre in Wight. It's an amazing story, what Heath and his team have done over there. Essentially, Heath started it with £1,000 of his own money, and in the last 5 or so years, they have taken it to the point where it's now worth somewhere in the region of £1.5 million per year to the local community. So we talk about what Heath has done and how they have got to that point. We cover things like, how do you quantify your success? The importance of planning, the importance of saying no to things, how you deal with volunteers and the difference between leading and managing people. And there's a very interesting part of our conversation where we talk about how the voluntary sector could perhaps be a little bit more professional in its approach to things sometimes. The thing that runs through this conversation more than anything else, I think, is how innovative Heath and his team have been over at Aspire. So here we go. Please do enjoy this conversation with Heath Monaghan. Okay, so I'm here today in the rather beautiful garden, actually, at Aspire in Ryde, and I'm here with Heath Monaghan. Good morning, Heath. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. And first thing I'd like to say, Heath, is thank you very much for giving up your time today. I know how busy you are and how much you have going on, so really appreciate that. To begin with, could you please give us, as I say, your Isle of Wight story? How did you end up down here on the island?
Well, my wife and I first visited the island 12 years ago with our daughter, who was just 3 months old. We were having a family holiday down here, our first family holiday, and we had a fantastic time, loved our time here, and did the whole tourist, wouldn't this be a nice place to live thing? Perhaps when we retire, and we kind of, that was all our statement was, and we just left it like that. Some 5 years later, every time we opened a newspaper or turned the radio on or even on the television, there was programmes about the Isle of Wight. There was articles about the Isle of Wight. And it was a constant barrage of Isle of Wight. And we kind of thought, perhaps there's something in this. And it was just at the time that our lives were starting to change. We were foster carers in the Midlands. That was coming to a natural end. The house that we was renting at the time was coming to a natural end, so we thought we'd go off and explore, and we came down and stayed. I looked through newspapers thinking, well, it will have to be a job that brings us here, and none of the jobs really ticked my box, and I kept looking from afar, looking at jobs, and eventually all of the stories much longer, a job came up that eventually became right for me, and a job brought me here. However, that was just to get me here and get the family here, because it's quite a big move. And actually, after 6 months of being here for that job, it didn't work out. So I find myself living here in Ryde thinking, oh my goodness, what on earth have I done? Move my family across the country, now what?
Okay. And but it's kind of worked out in the long run. We'll come on to that in a little while. But first of all, just to pick up on, did you spend a long time as a foster carer?
We did. We did 8 years for a county council in the Midlands, and it was fantastic. We loved doing it. We were able to deal with about 30-odd children over those period of times, and some really difficult, but some lovely children within that, and just saw the dramatic change that you can have in a child's or a young person's life. In fact, the real mad thing is, in that first year of fostering, I remember going from having no children whatsoever to having a troubled 14-year-old boy to having our own baby ourselves and twin baby girls all under the age of one. So we went from 0 to 4 in that first year of fostering.
Goodness me, that's okay. That's, you're a braver man than me. Let's just put it that way. So fostering is obviously something, you know, that we all have a rough idea of what's involved. What would you say was the biggest kind of lessons that you took from those 8 years?
Ooh, quite difficult to say, really. But I think we were the adults, and we had to be absolute consistent, set the behaviour and rules in our household. I'm sounding quite autocratic here when I do this, but I promise you it's not. But for children and young people who've had chaotic lifestyles, actually they crave knowing what their place in a family is. within all of that, to make sure that actually you're delivering a family lifestyle with plenty of love in it. And I think that's the thing that carried us through every one of our foster children being in our household.
Okay. And is that something, you know, that sort of care and things, that's something that I definitely notice when I come here, when I come to Aspire. Is that a sort of conscious thing on your part, those lessons, carrying them across?
Oh, absolutely. It's all we've done here is transferred that to a whole community and put some good listening skills, some good rules in place of what we can and what we can't do and achieve, and then to be able to love our whole community consistently.
Okay, that's interesting. So I'd love to pick up on what you said then about some of the things that you feel you can't do. But I think we'll come back to that in a minute, because I think probably we need to have a little bit of background about Aspire. Probably most people know the building on Dover Street here in Ryde. But tell us a little bit how it's transformed from a church into the community centre that it is now.
I'm a Christian chap and have got an active faith, so I would say it's God's plan rather than my plan, really. And I remember in the early days of, I alluded to it earlier, where I had that moment of thinking, what on earth have I done moving my family here to the Isle of Wight? And actually, this was the reason, this is why we moved to the Isle of Wight. There was a much bigger plan. And the story about how we acquired the building is fantastic. Really, through being quite cheeky and quite bold.
You're going to have to tell us about that.
Well, I was doing a little training course around something called Fresh Expressions of Church, how to make church a bit more relevant and funky and things like that. And I delivered that for the Archdeacon here on the Isle of Wight, who also had the ear of the bishop. And just at the end of the training course, I dropped in a little, I can't believe I'm living in Ryde, and Ryde hasn't got a community building. Any of the charities who are working are quite fragmented. There's no community hub. What Ryde really needs is a big community building. Why don't you give me a building to do it? So I just boldly asked outright. And there wasn't a shock horror. There was an absorbing of, this could be quite good, actually. And we are closing down a building in Ryde. We've been planning on closing the Holy Trinity Church down for about the last 10 years. We have no idea what to do with it. It's on the buildings at risk register. It's hopeless for car parking and a whole host of things. He didn't paint a good sales picture of the building at all. And I remember coming and viewing the building shortly afterwards and sitting at the back, looking around. And in a good day, you'd say it's shabby chic. But on a bad day when I'm feeling stressed, it is falling down around our ears somewhat. Yeah. Sitting at the back and thinking, gosh, no way. I don't want this building. I'll spend all my time just propping the blooming place up. I'll not get any community work done. I'll not draw the community together. But actually, little did I know that it was the fabric of this building that would start to draw the community together. And over the period of a week, I revisited a few times and discovered the labyrinth of rooms underneath it as well. And this bigger vision came into play at looking at children's balls and slides that could then pay for the upkeep of part of the building and some community works to happen and community kitchens. And I think that the pivotal moment was when I woke up one morning. And from our bedroom window, we'd not noticed this building before, but we'd woken up, and from our bedroom window, we could just see the very top of the steeple with a weather vane on. And I give my wife a nudge and said, see that building there? The Archdeacon and the Bishop have just offered it to us to do something with. And when she was immediately on board with her, this looks good. This is quite an innovative idea. There was a little bit of kicking in the early days with my wife, but we were both on board with it, and I knew, do you know what? There's something bigger about this place. And here we are, 5 years later.
Yeah, so, and that's quite a story. So I imagine that the early days must have been, you know, pretty tricky for you, just even getting the doors open. Were there any points where you thought, this is too much? I'm not sure I've made a good decision here.
I don't think there really were, actually. The early days of getting the doors open was quite simple and straightforward. the Archdeacon, Peter Sutton of the Isle of Wight, has just been a fantastic supporter and help. So the last service of Thanksgiving happened here. The very next day we were handed the keys, and it's been 5 years of exploration with the Church of England to work out what to do with this building. But what's the alternatives? Carpet warehouse, another pub, or even the diocesan secretary herself at the time was saying the value of the stone, the value of the land, outweighs the value of the building. It could get pulled down. So that was really a motivator for us to become engaged and want to save this really iconic structure for Ryde. English Heritage we brought on board in the early days, and their interest was this must be saved because it's part of a famous etching that happened in years gone by from the Solent. As you cross the Solent, the spires here of what was Holy Trinity Church and of All Saints, it frames the town of Ryde from the water. So it's an iconic structure. So it wasn't difficult to get in and get started. There were probably darker moments of thinking, my goodness, what have I done? This is hard work. And I probably try and kind of bluff my way through it in thinking it's not this one huge, big monster project that we've got, and to carve it into little bite-sized chunks. Someone wise once said to me, how do you eat an elephant? It seems like an impossible task, and actually the answer is you eat it one chunk at a time. And it's even easier if you have a party and invite other people to come and help you eat it. So really, that's what we've done here. I'm bluffing myself thinking of the size of this project. We're just having one bite at a time, and we're inviting other people to come and help and join in to develop this project.
Yeah. And so on turning that around then, was there a point at which you really kind of felt, yeah, we're here for good now. This is we've kind of not necessarily cracked it, because I know you don't think like that. But was there a point at which you went? Was there one particular event or something that happened? Yeah, that really made you go, yeah, we're on a roll now. Here we go.
Two things really. I mean, the risk element of it was my wife and I put £1,000 of our own savings in to start this project, and that's in our opinion what we felt we could afford to lose. It was the last of our savings. If not, it might have been departure of Isle of Wight and find a job somewhere else as such. I was working part time for the fire service at the time, so I had a little income trickling in. From that £1,000, we said, if it makes more money to pay for itself, fantastic, it'll work. If it doesn't and we lose that £1,000, then that's Endex, that's close it down, and there's nothing more we can do. And I'm glad to say I've constantly monitored the bank balance, and we've never dipped below that £1,000 level. In fact, we're slowly increasing our reserves into a good healthy place to be. The second part of that really would be about, we don't always get it right. So there was mistakes happened earlier on that we've learnt from, thinking that actually as a church building we might have all these fantastic Christian people coming to volunteer their time. That was the first mistake that I actually made. It was whole community that wanted to get involved here. And when we got to a tipping point where we had 80-odd people here volunteering their time throughout a period of a week, I kind of stood back and thought, there's something unique here. There's something special about this place. And clients started to flood in. And bit by bit, we just put things into place and equipped people to develop the projects and ideas that they wanted to. I think for me, the first signs of success would be to have our volunteer team happy and thriving, and that feeling of family or community. And people often refer to visiting now to Aspire as becoming part of the Aspire family. And that's part of our values. You alluded to it earlier. It's part of our value base for us as a couple to... we're seeing that now in our community building, that people have got those same values that are sharing right out and improving our community. I'm a bit of a data geek as well. So I, 3 years ago, started doing something called social impact. And it's collecting data of how many people come for different groups and classes and how many people cross the threshold for a cup of tea and all the basic stuff like that. And it's, I think it's quite important to gather that information. And there's some fantastic tools that have been developed by national government, by international studies and things like that, to actually quantify what each of those interactions financially would be worth. So, for instance, let's call a Mrs. Smith coming to our over 70s lunch programme, how that impacts on reduction of isolation, in better mental health and well-being, in that her she will have guaranteed at least one good nutritious meal a week, and how that then lessens the time and impact on a GP surgery, in mental health services, in that she's going to be in a better place to avoid slips, trips and falls because she's going to be more mobile getting here. All these things have got costs to it. So I can quantify some of those things. And we've seen a gradual increase over the last 3 years while we've been collecting this data and getting better at it as well, in how we now know the worth of our organisation. So, for instance, last year, for the first time, we celebrated £500,000 worth of fiscal savings from the public sector, of direct savings that we made, but £1 million worth of social impact into our town from our tiny budget. Of our turnover was £141,000 last year. So from £101,000 of impact of turnover to nearly £1.5 million of impacts into our town, that's 1,000% increase. So actually it's fantastic data to go to public sector organisations and to potential funders, and to be able to say, give us, for every pound you give us, that's what we're going to do with it. And they love that data. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And that's a brilliant concept, because I think for lots of us, we sort of instinctively understand that these sorts of things have an impact beyond sort of what you can immediately see. But the fact that there's ways that you can quantify that now, that's very interesting.
It is, and there's so much more. I mean, I look kind of to some of the Eastern cultures as well, in that they're not measuring pounds, shillings and pence. And there's a part of me that, whilst I love data and I've done that, that needs to happen to be able to quantify it. But there's some other measures which are far more important. Someone's happiness. Actually, how can we measure someone's happiness from walking through the door to how they're walked out? And it's an important one. We can't quite measure that, but we can certainly instill that it is going to take place and be transformative while they're here. So, for instance, one of our number one working objective as a whole team of staff and volunteers here is to have fun. And we will regularly actually close the whole project down. And we've now got 120 strong volunteers. So we'll say we are going to have a day today. And we did it last summer where we did things here in the garden that were fun. We made stamping and printing things, did giant bubbles, had a huge failure with what I was trying to do as the world's biggest paper aeroplane that didn't fly, whatever. But we had great fun in making it. I produced lunch for the team of volunteers, and we regularly go out for walks and some of these things to actually improve and impact their lives.
And then there's a ripple effect from that as well, from those 120 people. They're going out and spreading that message as well, right?
Absolutely. And that was something that I learned really early in my working life, that actually if I managed, I could achieve X, Y, and Z. But if I led a team of people to be the best that they can be, allow them to make mistakes and to celebrate those mistakes, then actually we can do the full alphabet, not just X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you've mentioned a lot about the values that you have personally, and also that the values that you have within the building here as well. Is that something that's grown up organically, or was there a sort of meeting where you guys kind of sat down and went, right, what do we stand for? What do we need to achieve here? How did that come about?
It has grown organically, but we've done both, I think, because my background is youth work, so I like post-it notes and consultations and finding out these, what's your thoughts? Because actually, if you don't believe in it, I can't just instill, this is the value, you've got to do it. It's got to be owned by the whole team. And of course, they are some people that just will not fit into this environment. They've got quite steadfast views and values that don't fit in. And that's fine, because everyone is individual and unique. So looking at the whole team, asking constant questions and doing some posted exercises over a period of years, not just quite a quick thing, we have worked out what our values as an organisation are. We've looked at our mistakes of, well, what have we learnt from that? What can we therefore input to make an impact in that area?
That's fascinating stuff. So you have such a wide variety. I was looking on your website yesterday. I mean, you've got everything from, you know, your Men in Sheds program, the minibus that's available. You've got NLP classes here. There's a choir and a music studio and a paint store and all these kind of things. How do they go about? How do they come about? Do you go out and actively seek people, or are they coming to you?
Now, Aspire is a facilitator. That's all we do, really. We try and facilitate other people. We facilitate other organisations. We facilitate our volunteers with mad and bad ideas. So I'm not a specialist in any of these areas of health and fitness and mental health and older people's services and music particularly. So I'm not a specialist in any of those areas whatsoever. What I do is I get alongside people who have got those specialist skills, who want to do something, and I enable them. We're a facilitator and an enabling organisation, that someone will come to us, on whether it be an organisation or an individual, with an idea. We'll help them to explore what that might look like. So it might be an organisation that just wants to deliver something here in Ryde, and that's a simple booking. That's fantastic. Our organisation can facilitate that happening, and it creates a little income to keep the organisation going, which is fantastic. But the other way of that happening is someone coming, they normally say, Heath, you need to do this. And that's a real kind of red flag to a bull kind of conversation to me. And it's, no, actually, you need to do this. How can we help you? So we've got a template, because again, as we've grown as an organisation, we used to just kind of crack on with every idea and have a few failures and a few difficulties in doing that. So we had to think, we need to think this through a bit more. So we've got a template that talks about the organisational reputation, talks about what resources are needed, how's it skilled and equipped, does it sit within our safeguarding policy, on who's insuring it, all of these real important practical questions that, if thought through in advance, has got a higher percentage chance of something becoming successful in doing it. So it's really, I mean, our music project would be a prime example. I am musically nil, and we've got here underground, a musician walked through one day with me several years ago and said, wow, this is an acoustically flat sound. I responded, you're talking foreign, what does that mean? And he went on to unpack what that means. And he said, it's perfect for rehearsing, it's perfect for recording in. And I went, that's fantastic, okay. And he then came back to me and said, well, I've been having a few conversations with another couple of bands and we want to use it to rehearse in. Is that all right? I said, yeah, come on, let's clear the area out and let's make it a usable space. And for a few months, it was just a rehearsal space. And then as we started to show more people around, there was a bit more interest in then setting up recording there. And again, if music's foreign to me, then recording is way, way over my head. So suddenly we were donated this huge recording studio, this sound desk, computers and all the kit. And some of the folks there start to learn how to do it. For me, I'm still told today, it's a room with the sliders and the twiddly knobs, and I'm not allowed to touch the equipment. And that's fine, because musicians come in there and they use the space really well. And what I can see is part of this building that is now got a little thriving community within it, and they're in turn teaching the wider community how to do musical and sound recordings and all of those kind of things.
That's fantastic. So is there, so the process could, as you said, it could literally just be someone at one end of the spectrum just coming in and hiring one of your rooms for an hour once a week or something like that to run a class. And then right at the other end of the spectrum, you've got these projects where you guys are a bit more hands-on. Is there anything, I mean, you have so much going on here. Is there anything missing at the moment? Is there something that you go, I wish we had one of those, or I wish we could do that?
I think I try not to think like that, otherwise we'd try and plug all the gaps. I think for me it's a really good question, but the makeup of what's happening inside our building should be a similar to makeup to what makes up our community outside of our building. And that's why it's so diverse, with lots of different groups operating, from everything from babies right through to older people. And all in between, and people with addiction, with mental health, homelessness. We deal with all of those issues that are in and around our town, or even the east coast of the Isle of Wight. And we are able to have an impact. It's bringing together people from whole community into a hub. And who's to say you need a professional to hold your hand through a particular way of living to change and transform that? Actually, the impact will happen by rubbing shoulders, who's either got learned and lived experience in that area or is living in a different way. And I'm from the northeast of England, and that's my cultural community. And when I was growing up in the 1980s there, then you had Aunt Ethel live around the corner, and my granny would live around that corner, and we had those family values on our street. And if I did something wrong, actually, I know there was someone down the street I could go and talk to about it and deal with. And the whole street was there looking out for and being family together and growing those tight-knit communities. So that's what we've really done here in this building. We have grown a much tighter-knit community, because as I've done, families are far more fragmented than ever before in the UK and in other areas of the world. And we, because of technology and because of better travel and network and infrastructure and jobs, we are fragmented from our initial birth families. And I think that's in every town just about across the YMCA, even in the northeast. So I moved my family right across the UK, so I'm to blame for this happening. So this is something that we can perhaps make a space where people can get together and have those values again, and offer love and support for each other. And I think that's referring back to my earlier comment on people say it's like joining the Aspire family.
Yeah. And that's a fantastic thing. And long may it continue, I say. So talking about long may it continue, how do you see things progressing for Aspire over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Yes, it will grow organically. There is a loose plan in place. The very early vision was to have this community hub, which is very clear. It's here and identified. In fact, we've actually outgrown this building. So we are looking at what we can do about that. So we've now purchased our Balls and Slides play frame for the main hall, so it'll become more of a family attraction. That'll both trickle in an income to pay for the upkeep of the building and some of the community projects. But it'll also safeguard this building for the long-term future, and mean we can reach out much better with families, etc. So in order for that to happen, some of our projects will need to find a new home elsewhere. So we're seeking and looking, pressing kind of doors and exploring what else might be. But we've already really started to spread our wings a little bit, in that we've got our free book stalls in Wootton and Haven Street. We've got our gardening herbs for free planting. Snip and take projects on the train stations in St John's, Brading and Sandown, which is just about to be launched. And already a question around, because we deliver a little bit of accommodation in our Hope House project here for vulnerable ladies, and which has been an absolute rip-roaring success. And already the question of when can the next one be? And from a councillor previously was kind of saying, when can we have an Aspire in every community on the Isle of Wight? Well, I don't think that's the answer, because actually there's other good organisations dealing with some stuff, and every community is different. So the next 5 years really will be getting the building up to spec. It clearly was, I mean, it was built in 1840, so it's not fit for purpose to today's needs. Looking at how we can put in new staircases and an elevator to make it accessible and to make it a useful and fully used space, and how we can have a greater impact further afield.
And I mean, that all sounds amazing. So what do you need? What can people do to contribute to that? Does it boil down to cash, or are there other things that people could contribute here?
There's lots of things to contribute here, really. And let me tell you a story. I mean, we started with £1,000, and I realised quite quickly that people wanted to help and to get engaged. So in order to fix the roof, did I need to put a thermometer out the front that most churches do, and have a raise the roof appeal? Or did we need to be a bit more different and innovative in how we think? So to make sure this £1,000 didn't diminish and disappear, instead we'd get quite cheeky. We'd ring up on a Friday afternoon to a local builder or local roofer and say, "We can't afford to pay you, but would you be able to come along and fix our roof? You'll feel really good about yourself this weekend." And actually, to ask for someone's time rather than their money is much easier. It gets them more involved and they feel part of what's happening in their local community. And I have to say, we've had rip-roaring success of doing that in all aspects of people donating equipment and items, people coming and giving their labour and their time, their specialist time, for free. And therefore they want to come back in a year's time to see how we're getting on. And so we've done a lot of things quite boldly, really, without just asking for money. Money is important, of course it is. And as we've grown year on year, our impact has grown year on year. And we do need money to be able to pay for things. So our kitchen team are constantly pulling their hair out because we take a whole raft of food from supermarkets. That's at its best before date. And every day here at Aspire is ready, steady, cook. You don't know what's coming in till it arrives. And there's some things that just don't come in, like meats and things like that we have to go out and buy. So to be able to feed the homeless and feed the elderly. And our volunteers, we feed our volunteers every day to get that sense of family feeling across.
Yeah, that's... So are there... Have you got a couple of jobs hanging around now that you could really do with a couple of specialists for?
Absolutely. There's always some jobs to do here at Aspire.
Okay, well, what do you need?
At the minute, we need someone to come and to do some pointing, because back in the 80s, the church that were here, bless them, they pointed a lot of this limestone rubble building with cement and mortar, and it's damaging the stone quite massively. That's a huge undertaking. So we need to actually go back through and repoint every part of this building using proper heritage techniques. And that's something that we can actually show you and train individuals who have got some building expertise, or it might be something that someone's already got and wants to come and help us to train some other people on.
Yeah, okay. And when I go around and I talk to people, generally most people that you talk to want to help. They want to do something. They like the idea of contributing in some way. But if you've never done it before, it can be quite almost intimidating. It can be quite a hard thing to walk into a building like Aspire and go, "Hey, I'm here. What can I help? What can I do?" What would you suggest to people who are maybe in that position? You know, they want to help. Maybe they don't have a specific skill that would be obviously useful to you guys, but they want to come along and help out. What would you suggest to those people?
Again, we've learned over the last 5 years, we don't have a job description for our cafe volunteers or our community kitchen volunteers. Instead, we do volunteering very differently here, and we've been inundated over the years, and we've got a huge team of fantastic volunteers who want to get involved of all different levels. So we have a system in place where every week I do a tour of the building for a team of people who are interested, would-be volunteers. So first of all, come in and have a chat to one of our volunteers and find out what it's really like. Get the real story rather than the glossy picture that I do, to find out what it's like to volunteer here. Book onto one of the weekly tours to find out all of the different projects that happen here. And that'll give you a sense and an idea of, well, where you might fit in. We then ask for an application form and check your references so we can find out a bit more about you. But not having a job description, it's then down to the person doing the interview to tease out, well, what are your skills? What are your strengths? What are you naturally good at? What's your passions? And we'll form a volunteer role around those areas, because it means that you're far more likely to enjoy it, you're far more likely to stick around much longer and have a much better experience as a volunteer. It doesn't mean that you can't do challenging stuff, by the way. It's a safe place to think, well, no, I've worked in a kitchen all my life, but I quite fancy having a go at some DIY. Well, this is a safe space to learn some of those skills and do it as well. But just in forming a role around your skills and your strengths, it's the best tip and advice I can give to any voluntary sector organisation.
Okay, and then what... I don't know, the last thing I want to do is sort of put people off here, but what sort of, is there any kind of minimum commitment? Does it need to be a minimum number of hours per week or something for it to work for you guys? Or?
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. Most people do come here and get quite impassioned and buy into what we're doing here and want to do 5 days a week. And actually we say no. No one should do 5 days a week here because you'll burn yourself out. And really, I think a morning or two or a day or two a week is more than enough for anyone. And you can always grow it and do more over time if you want. And in fact, we've got people who, one chap who is a chef who is away in the Merchant Navy, and he comes back home and he'll do a couple of weeks intensively here, and then we don't see him for another 3 or 4 months. And that works just as good as being here consistently every Monday morning, etc. And we've a wonderful lady who is off and very busy doing university studies, so during the long summer holiday she comes and volunteers her time here. So we're really open around individuals and what their needs are.
Okay, and as you say, that sort of synergy of making it work for both sides.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So looping back around to something you mentioned a little while back, you sort of in passing mentioned about things that you can't do. And I don't want this to be a sort of negative thing, but one of the things that I personally feel quite strongly about for all of us as individuals and organisations, it's important to have an understanding of where your strengths and where your weaknesses lie. You know, how can you best invest your time? So when you said the things that we can't do, could you give us a little bit more detail about that?
From an organisational
point of view? Yeah, from an organisational point of view.
I think there's things that are funded and better placed by other organisations. So whilst we might see a huge, vast need in a particular walk of society, are we best skilled and equipped and placed to be able to deliver that? Or is it a more realistic view to say, no, there's a different organisation? So for instance, when we were asked to do a particular project, and I'm being quite cagey and careful because I don't want to name the organisation, our first port of call was to say, that's a fantastic idea and this needs to happen, and this organisation are better placed to deliver it. They've got a specialism in that area. So we started a dialogue with them and said, we've got the client group, we've got the building, we've got the volunteers, come and deliver it. Their response was, no, there's no funding attached to it. But actually, we're quite innovative here at Aspire. And I said, well, clients will pay X amount to come to it. It can be self-funding. It doesn't need to make a vast profit. As long as it washes its face, come and deliver it. No, they wouldn't do it without the funding. So first of all, we made an approach to an organisation because they were better placed, in our opinion, to deliver it. And when they flatly refused to deliver it, then we stepped in and we've delivered it. And actually, it's one of our projects that's thriving and has been for since day one. And okay. I love that we're doing it.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. So, I mean, that brings up a sort of broader question, really, as we possibly wait for the plane to go by. It brings up a broader question of... And again, I don't want this to turn into, you know, some kind of, you know, tirade. But do you encounter that kind of problem regularly? Is there something, if we talk about the sort of thing that Aspire do, is the community centre, that kind of giving back sort of thing. If we talk about that as, for want of a better expression, an industry for now. Mm-hmm. I know it's not a conventional industry like, you know, gas companies or something like that. But is there something within the giving industry, for want of a better expression, that you encounter time and time again that you kind of go, ah, I wish we could do something about that?
I think it would be in strengthening the rest of that industry or the rest of the voluntary sector, actually. I love the voluntary sector dearly. It's doing a massive amount of great work, a lot of it unmeasured, and I'd like to see a bit more professionalism around measuring the impacts and celebrating those impacts, and to be more business-like. So, for instance, I take great pride and joy that we produce fantastic financial sets of accounts here every year, and we're responsible to the Charity Commission for that. There's a whole raft of people trying to do some good in the community that might not be regulated. There are a whole raft of organisations that are not as professional as they could be. And we've actually helped to strengthen and to get alongside a number of those organisations and to work in partnership with some of them. And they've now got some strategy, they've got some structure, they've got a clear direction, and they're thriving now. So from taking those kind of seeds of want to do something good in the community to moving it on to a full strategy of how to do something good and how to not just be ticking by and panicking about when grants and donations don't come in and things like that, but actually to get to a point where they're thriving, then I take great delight at that personally, because we're seeing much, much more fantastic work happen right across this island.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're almost talking about having, in a sense, a more business-like, a more professional approach, in a way, to kind of volunteering and this sort of thing.
Absolutely, and I talked about it in how we attract volunteers. So it'd be so easy just to open the doors and say, yeah, come in, everybody, come and join the party. But you've got to look at safeguarding. You've got to look at how you support volunteers, how you can have an audit trail of paperwork to say, this is what we have done, this is why we've made these decisions. And the same with how you, particularly money for voluntary sector organisations is really, really quite tight. And grant funding has been diminishing. Grants from the public service have more or less disappeared now. So it's a real difficulty for voluntary sector organisations to fight for grant funding. But actually, I'd like to say, look at that challenge. Don't fight for funding. Look at innovative ways of how we talked about one of the projects earlier on, about how it can be financially self-supporting and self-sustainable. And that's really the model that we've built this project on. We don't receive a penny of public sector funding here. We have focused entirely on capital grant funding as a one-off to do the building up and to equipment and things. Very rarely do we seek any revenue funding, because at the end of 2 years, of course, it comes to an end and the clients get hurt, the staff and volunteers get hurt, the whole community gets hurt. Whilst you can't say that good work hasn't happened in that two-year period, of course it has, but the legacy that's left normally is a legacy of hurt. So is there a different way of doing things in a more financially self-sustainable fashion? And things like developing a play structure, a trading arm of a voluntary sector organisation to actually pay for some of the community things. So for us, it means that our £1,000 in year one has been really well spent. It's gone on to have a massive value of £1.5 million each year. And it means that we'll be here not just for the lifetime of a funding stream, but that we'll be here in another 5 years, in another 10 years, because the project is in good financial health.
Yeah, that's amazing. And yeah, that's just seems to me like such a just a more sensible way to approach it. If you can make things self-sustaining, self-supporting, then in the long term, that's going to work a little bit better. So, coming towards the end now, Heath, one other question that I'd like to ask you. Obviously, with everything that you've seen and all the experiences that you've had in this sector, is there a piece of bad advice that you hear given out, or is there one particular mistake that you see made quite frequently that you sort of kind of go, oh God, I wish I could just stop people doing that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a thing that I learned very, very early on,
right.
How to be an encourager and not to be an overpowering manager. And I used to work for the YMCA delivering outdoor education and training to huge hurly-burly blokes from Nissan up in Sunderland. And I realised at the age of being a snotty 18-year-old, I couldn't tell people what to do, otherwise I'd have got thumped by them. So instead I had to find a way of persuading and encouraging and getting them to want to believe that's what they wanted to do, and to find out what they wanted to do and to move them into that way. So really that's been my life's work, of being a leader rather than a manager, and there's a distinct difference. So we don't manage a specific process. Instead, I lead a team of people to have a greater impact. So don't manage processes. Don't manage your organization in a tight, overbearing way. Instead, look to release people to be the best that they can and learn from mistakes along the road. They'll thrive and grow and develop. Your organization will thrive and grow and develop.
So there's something in what you just said that's very close to my heart. That difference between leading and managing, is that something that you feel can be taught, or do you have to just get stuck in and get your hands dirty?
I think you've got to realize that there's a difference between the two, and it took me a few years to realize that there's a difference between the two. It is something that can be taught, I think, and I think read some fantastic books. There's a great organization called the Happy Foundation. He does some amazing work on this, and go and explore and try it. Try it in a voluntary sector organisation. Try it in your workplace. Have a chat with your direct line manager and say, I want to try and do something a little bit different. Can we put it on trial and see how it works? If it works, fantastic. Hopefully productivity will go through the roof. And if it doesn't, well, you can learn from why hasn't it worked.
So if this is something that we can learn, you mentioned that, so the Happy Foundation, is that a series of books or resources? What other resources might you point people towards for this kind of
thing?
There's
a massive wealth of there are literally hundreds of thousands of leadership training manuals, etc. So you've got to find the one that works for you and the stance and style that works for you. So go and explore, have some fun, Google it, and work out what works for you.
Is there one in particular that if you could go back in time and give something to your 18-year-old self dealing with those big guys in Nissan, is there something that you'd give to yourself at that point and say, hey, give yourself a week, go read this or go watch that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it would be Henry Stewart from the Happy Foundation. He has a happy manifesto, how to make workplaces a happy environment. And the real challenge that last year I brought back to this organization is to not be as controlling and power crazy as such. So to actually pre-authorize some projects, give permission up front for people to work at and learn from their mistakes. So for instance, an example would be a recent project here where I set there's the limit of budget that you can spend in this project. You know how it's got to fit into our organisation values and objectives. You've got all the skills to be able to do this, and you can ask the other teams here at Aspire for help and support. Have you got any questions? No? Crack on with it. I'll see it when it's done. Not that I want a weekly or a monthly check-in meeting to see how you're getting on, because again, there's a likelihood of me trying to twist and tweak it to my vision. And instead, I want this team, this person, to have their own vision of what that should look like. And as long as they're following the ethos and the vision and values of the organisation, they're going to get it perfectly right. In fact, they might even be better placed to be delivering this project than I might be.
That's fascinating. So I mean, that's a huge level of trust on your part. So lots of questions. Would Would someone have demonstrated some, you know, competence to you before you'd give them that much trust, or is that something that you just kind of start with?
You start in a much smaller way on day one of do they know how to organise this, to do this small, simple task, etc. And you build up to then the major projects. And you will watch and you'll see that they're demonstrating time in, time out, that they've got the values of the organisation in their decision making. So then you'll know, you'll get it and think, yeah, that's a safe pair of hands to leave that project in. It's still scary. There's still a risk to it that it will go entirely wrong. But actually, what's the worst case scenario of that risk going entirely wrong? If it's a calculated mistake, you can always repair it and you can learn masses from it. And actually, the value of that can far outweigh even the project in the first place in someone's growth and development. And best case scenario is that it massively improves the organisation, that it improves their motivation and their passion for the organisation as well, in seeing something that they've come up with a concept and outworked all the way through to completion, and it's here, it's making a difference in the community.
And you touched on this at the beginning of that as well, that the idea that if you give somebody free rein like that, there's also a good chance that they'll do better than you were expecting, that they'll approach it from a different angle or have a different perspective on it that takes it in a project that, that perhaps you yourself might never have thought of.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's amazing. So, right, I really appreciate your time today, Heath, and we're just sort of wrapping up now. Before we do, two questions. The first one would be, for people listening, what would you like them to do? Where would you maybe suggest they start if they're interested in what goes on at Aspire?
Look at our website. Things change here on a, if not daily, hourly basis. And our website, we try and keep as up to date as possible. So once we've printed a leaflet, it's out of date immediately. So look at the website, see what's happening. Support it. Talk about this thriving community at Aspire Ride and spread the word. That is the best form of marketing. And I often say we're rubbish marketeers here at Aspire because we've got our head down, too busy doing the work. But actually, it's the fantastic community around us that are doing marketing for us because they're spreading the word about what we do here.
And just to finish up with, Heath, as someone who's relatively new to the island, I know you said you've been here quite a lot, you know, as you were growing up and stuff. What's something that happens on the island that you think islanders don't take advantage of enough, or that you wish more people knew about? And you're not allowed to say Aspire.
Mm-hmm. There's some research being done into green spaces doing you really good, and also some new research about blue spaces, meaning the sea, doing you good. And actually, we're living on an island that's really struggling with mental health. So I think two things. Make use of those green spaces, the woods, the fields, countryside. Make use of the beach, this glorious island beaches that we've got right round. Make good use of them and talk. Form community, talk between yourselves, each other, and build community where you live and connect in with that community, because talking about it, accessing those green and blue spaces and talking things through will make everyone's health far, far better. And if we use that happiness index or indicator, you'll go from having a not so good day into feeling much, much better about yourself.
Excellent. I literally cannot think of a better way to end. Heath, thank you ever so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. For those of you listening, if you check out the show notes, there'll be links to all the things that we've talked about, including the Aspire website and the Happy Foundation material that Heath mentioned earlier. So once again, Heath, thank you ever so much. Really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely delighted. Thank you for inviting me.
So there we have it. That was Heath Monahan. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. That actually brings us to the end of season one of the Isle of Wight show. Before we say goodbye for the time being, if you want to find more out about Aspire, then you can do that at my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. And there you will also find my blog and details of my book, The Self-Help Summary, which I published at the end of last year. We will be back. In the meantime, do please keep an eye out for us. If you get a minute to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. Or do please tell a friend or have a listen back to some of the earlier episodes if you haven't done that already. We will be back soon. In the meantime, though, thank you very much for listening today. We really appreciate that. And yeah, we look forward to catching up with you again soon. Cheers. Hey, everybody. I'm working on a new podcast project at the moment. This one is about people who have faced and overcome problems. If you know someone, maybe they have recovered from a serious accident or illness, perhaps they beat an addiction of some description, or maybe their life just hit a bit of a rough patch and they found a way to get through it. Whatever it might be, if you or someone you know would be happy to share the story with me, then I'd really love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me via my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much.